Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
And my name is Dick.
Now the person who's going to be joining us, who always is there, is Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick try to act as the coordinators, interlocutors, whatever, of the technical men. Main purpose of the technical men, most of you guys already know that, is to transfer information among ham radio operators. We gather the clan and we help each other understand how all of this complicated hardware works. It's overly obvious that schools do not do a thorough job of teaching wireless technology, radio technology. A person gathers that information by way of an apprenticeship program. 10 or 20 years of working with a company that produces wireless products will give you the working knowledge of being a good radio frequency engineer, antenna engineer, propagation, a predictor, things like that. As I said, the schools do a fairly poor job of that, in my opinion. If you really want to know somebody, if you want to hire a person who understands radio, quite often you're going to be hiring a ham radio operator, because he's got the passion, the hands-on experience. He's been there, he's done that. He likes it, he's learned how to do it, he's bought the book, he's read the book, he's discussed it with all of his fellow ham radio enthusiasts, and they trade information back and forth. This is one of the places where that trading of information takes place. The TechNet has been around for 27 and a quarter years. This happens to be TechNet number 1,285 of the series that began in September of 1982. Essentially every single Sunday since then, there has been a technical net in the New York City area. Make sure you guys try to look at your watch when you're doing talking. Let me drop. Because you have to wait for the beep to reset the machine. There are people outside of the area listening to this repeater by way of Echo Link and IRLP and whatever. And if we don't wait long enough for that beep, then you don't reset the machine. It times out the link, and the people outside of the area suddenly get a multiple minutes of interruption. It becomes very frustrating for them. Also, while you're talking, please look at your watch. And when the second hand goes around 1 1/4 times, you know, a minute and 15 seconds approximately, do an interruption and wait for the beep. If you don't, you'll time out the system. Some of the subjects we've gotten on in the past, we get pretty hot and heavy and enthusiastic, and quite a few people jump the gun, don't wait for the beep, talk for more than 2 minutes, time out the machine in multiple ways. We've had a lot of that in the last couple of weeks. Let's see if we can avoid some of that tonight. In a minute, I'm going to be asking for check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment for the net. We also have a carryover from last week. At the end of last week, Charles, KC2, Fox Alpha, signed in, and I promised him he'd be number one on the runway if he comes back this week. Also, quite a bit has occurred, in my opinion, on the subject of the Toyota runaway accelerator problem, and I think you should have some of that information, because we ham radio operators use radios in our car, and if the car malfunctions while we're doing that, that could be a dangerous situation. So we're going to have a little bit of a discussion of that. So let's find out who's around with real questions or comments, and that's the way you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment. If you're just listening, you need not sign in. After 27 years in the tri-state area, we sort of accept the fact that somebody out there is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. So give me your call letters and name. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2EO, Rich, and yes. Just for instance. Give me your call letters and name and that yes at this time. K2RIW, my name is Dick, and we're listening.
N2XJN and Wesley, yes.
W2ILT, Bob, yes.
Okay, I heard Wesley and Bob, and there was a third person that was doubled on top of. Who was that third person?
W2OY1, go, yes. Okay, good evening. MFA, Charlie, why? Yes.
Okay, so far we've got Wesley, Bob, Joe, Mel, and Charles. And Charles is going to be number one on the runway, as we said before. Is there anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters, name, UIW. Go ahead, Charles.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. I think I have a pretty simple question. I'm going to be purchasing a Geisel 2 meter 440 mobile, hook it up in the house, and I want to hook it up to a disc cone, a radio track disc cone antenna, which I have in the attic. I'm using it right now. I've been using it for 10 years with my 2 meter ICOM, and I had it checked on an analyzer at 146, and it was fantastic. Now, Radio Shack says it will transmit on 440. Is that safe to assume, or should I check it with an SWR meter, which I don't have, or what do you recommend? KC2, FFA.
Okay, Joe, we heard you sign in earlier. Just let me find out now. Joe, if you've got an opinion on this one, have you used a disc cone antenna? Go right ahead, Joe.
Yes, sir. Good evening. W4YY. Name is Joe. Yes, I am using a disc cone antenna to transmit right now on 2 meters. It does work on 440, but the results are a little less desired than an antenna that is resonant to the band. It'll show you a moderate amount of return loss, like, say, minus 10 dB, minus 12, across the amateur band, but it does not work as well as an antenna that's actually made to resonate correctly in the 440 amateur band. So the results will be a little less desired than what you probably expect out of it.
Good information, Joe. So you saw a minus 10 dB reflection coefficient, which, by the way, corresponds to a tiny bit better than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And by the way, you worded that, I sensed that on 440 is where you saw the 10 dB reflection coefficient. And was the standing wave ratio or reflection coefficient a little bit better on 2 meters? Back to you, Joe.
Yes, it was. I don't recall the exact numbers on 2 meters, but it was a bit better than it was on 440. The antenna I happen to have is a ICOM AH7000, and it goes from 25 to 1300 meg, and it has the element on top that gives you a little better performance on 6 meters. And the antenna actually does work on 6 meters rather decently for what it is. But of course, the rest of the band is sort of like moderate. Maybe it's about, I think it's about maybe 15, minus 15 dB on 144 to 147 megahertz. It's a little worse on the 440 band. 220 is not as good as my other antenna I've had up there on the band 220. So its performance, I would say, rating, which is relatively, is sort of like, you know, a compromise than a really good band antenna.
Very fine, Joe. Okay, there's real hands-on experience on the AH7000. I think you said it was a Cushcraft model number, rated for 25 to 1300 megacycles, 25 megahertz to 1300. The disc cone antenna concept is one of many kinds of antennas that are known to be broadband. Disc cone is a vertically polarized, very broadband antenna, and it's omnidirectional. That's the good news. Log periodics are also a very broadband antenna, usually horizontally polarized, usually squirting the signal mostly in one direction. Either of those kinds of broadband antenna, with proper design principles, could have a reasonably low standing wave ratio. I didn't say it's easy. And if, for instance, the one that you have in your hand, Charles, has, let's say, a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio on 2 meters and a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on 440, that's not bad. Modern day rigs for 2 and 440 are quite forgiving. Rigs on 80 through 10 meters, the so-called no-tune rigs, they're pretty persnickety. Some of them want no more than a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, otherwise they trip out or go into the low-power mode. Most of the 2-meter rigs in 440 are quite a bit more forgiving. On top of that, the antenna itself, what its standing wave ratio is, let me drop. It's going to be modified by the true insertion loss of your particular feed line. Quite possibly you're going to locate the feed line, the antenna, on, let's say, the chimney of your house, and maybe there's 30 feet of feed line going to it. And maybe your 30 feet of feed line is going to have 2 decibels of insertion loss. These are possible real numbers. The nice thing about knowing the insertion loss of your cable and knowing that the standing wave ratio, each individual standing wave ratio has a number of decibels of return signal. In other words, you could say if I transmit 100 watts, exactly what's going to happen in your installation. If my antenna had, for instance, a 10 dB reflection coefficient on 440 megacycles, and my feed line had 2 dB of loss, let's see how we can combine all that. The signal goes up the feed line, experiences 2 dB of loss. Of the power that's left over, most of it gets transmitted by the antenna. A small portion of it, one-tenth of it, gets reflected by the antenna, and it comes back down. So you get 2 dB of loss on the way up, 10 dB of reflection coefficient of the antenna, in my example, another 2 dB of loss coming back all the way down, at the total of 4 dB of transmission line loss round trip, for 10 dB of reflection coefficient becomes 14. 14 dB of reflection coefficient, I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's probably something like a 1.6 standing wave ratio, and we can look that one up. So, as your feed line, with properly installed connectors, as you start including the real insertion loss of your feed line, your apparent standing wave ratio of the antenna gets better and better. The bottom line of all this, let me drop. If I were you, Charles, I would just go and use it. Even if your rig went into a fairly high standing wave ratio, almost all of them these days, with rare exception, have built-in protection circuits, pretty solid final stage amplifiers, and nothing bad is going to happen. If you want to be a real scientist, you actually measure with a bird watt meter, a standing wave ratio meter, or whatever. You measure the ratio of forward power versus reverse power and come to the conclusion that it's okay or not so okay. 10 dB of reflection coefficient or better, one-tenth the power coming back to the transmitter after the feed line loss is usually quite good. If the power coming back to you is only 6 dB down, I don't know the exact numbers, but maybe that's a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, that's beyond my threshold of alarm. Your rig's not going to blow up, but you wouldn't want to dwell in that mode for very long. So I'd go and use it. I think you're 98% safe, and if someone will loan you a standing wave ratio, a bird watt meter, or whatever, that runs at 440, you can apply it and check it out, and therefore sleep much more soundly at nighttime, Charles. Good question. KC2, Fox Fox Alpha, K2RIW. You got it, Charles. Wait for the beep. Look for your watch.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Father. Now, that's what I wanted to know. But I didn't want to ruin the radio for a couple of days. I originally put the disc phone up with Janet. Then I got my handwriting. Then I got the icon, and it always worked fine. I used to even do simplex to fairly local people. And that's what I really wanted to know. The disc phone works nice. And, I think maybe I'll purchase the MSJ SWR watt meter. It's only another $50. And hook it up between, and then I know I feel a little bit better. Thanks a lot, everybody. KC2FS.
And when you do either buy or borrow a meter that allows you to measure reflected power or standing wave ratio, please come back, Charles, and let us know what you found out. And once again, you can tell us, but it's a disc cone that covers 6 and 2 meters. If you happen to know what brand name and what model number are you using, Charles, go ahead.
Sure. You go to the Radio Shack website, and you type in 20, it's there, 043. It has the PDF online, and it has everything in there. It's the same as his. I think it goes from 30 to 1300. And like I said, I bought it for scanning. It's omnidirectional. It's a nice built antenna. I was very happy with it. And I think I actually spent $10 less than the charging now. So, good stuff. KC2FS.
Charles, on a quick return, roughly how many dollars did that cost when you bought it?
I believe it was $59.
Very good. That sounds like a lot of money, a lot of bang for the dollars, and a lot of megacycles. I've worked on antennas that have to be broadband, and as long as you've got enough real estate, it's a very doable thing. Whenever you take any antenna and squeeze it down in size, for a whole bunch of reasons, it's going to become narrowband. And it looks like the Discone didn't suffer that. It's one of the, when properly designed, it's a broadband antenna. And by the way, even if it were, Charles, you discover that at 2 meters you like the performance, and at 440 you don't like the performance. People like Mel and Dick and others can teach you how to put a sub tuner or other simple things on the antenna to make the standing wave ratio on 440 get better. It may sacrifice the performance a little bit somewhere else, like 220, so to speak, but if 2 meters and 440 are your favorite band and you want to make an improvement, you'll be amazed how easy that is to do. And so when you come back after your measurement, if you want to go to the next step in your science project and make it better in performance at 440, there's a smart on this repeater that's going to teach you how to do it. And once you've solved that problem, because that's a very popular, easy-to-obtain, commercially available product in essentially every Radio Shack store in the United States, once you've solved that problem, you can then write an article for the technical topic in QST Magazine. Fame and fortune will come upon you after that. People will be knocking on your door, handing you money. Believe that, I'll tell you another, but I'm serious when I say once you solve that problem and make that improvement and you write a technical topic, write an article for technical topics with QST, and they print it, you'll be seeing your name in print, and you'll kind of like it, so consider that. The next person who signed in was Wesley. Let me drop.
I got a comment on that.
Oh, go right ahead, Mel. K2KEY. You were dropping out a little bit. I hope your signal's going to be stronger. K2KEY, K2RAW.
Okay, why should you be dropping out tonight? If you look in the antenna, ARRL antenna manual, they had a section there on disc cones and how to make the disc cones work better. In fact, it's how to modify disc itself and etc. And the disc cone that they describe, you can modify any disc cone to it, will work then fairly well, they said, for from 50 megahertz, 144, 220, etc. It's very clear instructions of what to do to your disc cone, or if you want to build one from scratch, basically, but you can modify what you have, appropriately, so whatever.
Very glad you gave us that. That's darn good information, Mel. Just to be sure that it's going to be in the issues that we all have, you happen to know which particular edition of the ARRL antenna book you're looking at. You have reason to believe that that disc cone improvement article is in more than just the very latest edition, if you know what I mean. In other words, if I go to my bookshelf and I pick up my particular issue, is that the disc cone improvement article likely to be there? Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
No, I just happened to remember it, and I pulled the book just to be sure that my memory wasn't failing me at where I saw it. This was in the 18th edition of the ARRL antenna book. 18th edition, whether or not I have to, take the other ones off the shelf and stop looking. But it definitely was covered in the 18th edition takeover.
Very good, and I also want a quick break. Does that information tell you how to homebrew it if you wanted to? I'm guessing since it's in the ARRL antenna book, the full recipe for homebrewing is quite possibly there. Is that true?
Yeah, they cover all disc cone antennas, everything including how to build an HF disc cone antenna. That is quite a project. But the popularity of the VHF, UHF disc cone, has really put it on the map. I don't know, the only different type or antennas that are umbrella, they actually called it the type of an umbrella, was the Collins version that they built some years ago. They were marketing, but the ones that the amateur radio basically are interested in is our so-called, disc cone that we envision, and that's what they have in there. How to determine what and where the disc cone, how to put it together, how to determine the disc, how to determine the side pieces and everything. It's a whole story on it, Dick, and how to, all the formulation for you to, either modify or build a new one. Over.
Very fine. The actual raw materials that go into a VHF, UHF version of a disc cone antenna, one that covers approximately 30 to 1300 megacycles, those raw materials probably the choice here of either going into Radio Shack and buy the 20-048 item for approximately $59. Maybe it's going up to $62 now. Or you can decide to build your own. You also have the option of, in the case of Charles' situation, where he already owns one, he could, at his decision, build a second one and use them as a phased array. Feed the signal to both of them simultaneously. And if he feeds the two signals to them side by side, broadside to the main repeater he cares about, he will be 3 decibels stronger in those directions. In other words, if you set the two antennas, one east and one west of each other, he would be making a two-element interferometer, which would give a main lobe to the north and a main lobe to the south. And those main lobes to the north and the south would be 3 decibels stronger than with a single antenna. That would be another fun project. And by way of changing the length of the feed line to one antenna versus the other, you then can steer that beam around the compass. Favor the east direction, favor the west direction, or favor north and south simultaneously. And that's another great experiment. We amateurs can do an awful lot with antennas because most of the time the raw materials that go into an antenna are fairly inexpensive. We have the enthusiasm to do the building, to do the tuning, do the testing, get on the air and compare. You've got your normal antenna on one end of the house on the roof, and on the other end of the house on the roof you've got this new experimental antenna. You call up your buddies and say, I'm going to antenna number one and antenna number two. How strong is the signal now? You can have a lot of fun with this. Building your own antennas, testing them, making them improved, understanding how they work, great thing for amateurs to do. When I was first cutting my teeth in the amateur radio, and so was Mel way back in the 1950 time frame, a substantial percentage of the amateurs then built their own transmitter and built their own receiver. That's essentially out of the question, with rare exception nowadays. With 1 or 2 weeks worth of salary, you can buy a rig these days that if you wanted to build it, would take you a man's year, and it's not cost effective. You buy a respected brand of rig today with 1 or 2 weeks of your salary, and if you don't like it 6 months from now, you can sell it, and in many cases get 80% of your money back. If you buy the right one in the first place, because you've used word of mouth recommendations by the buddies you talk to on the air, you're probably going to fall in love with it, and it's going to stay with you forever. This particular rig you're listening to, let me drop, is an oldie but goodie. It's a Kenwood TS711A, a 2-meter all-mode rig. It covers 144 to 148 with all possible modes. Only has 30 memories. It was popular way back in the late 80s, but it's got its own built-in 110-volt power supply. I can completely variably adjust the power output between 0 and 10 watts. Yes, it only has 0 and 30 watts. And so it's variable in power output. It's got an awful lot of the features that I like. And on the surplus market, you can buy this particular 2-meter all-mode rig at times for a couple of $100s. To buy a rig with the exact same performance today, a 2-meter all-mode, you can easily spend $1,500, $1,800. Are you really getting that much more with all that extra money? I can buy seven of those. I can buy seven of these things for the price of one of those. So it pays you money, it takes your choice. And when you've got people like Andy, WATCDL, around that can fix anything, so buying a used rig, even if it's in non-operative condition, is not a showstopper. So give that some thought. We all like to save money once in a while. Let me drop and I'll tell you what's coming next.
E2SYL with a comment.
Okay, I heard SYL. Start up with your name, because I should know you, but I'm forgetful. Mr. SYL, give me your full call and name, and go right ahead with your comment.
Yes, the name is Bill. The call sign is KC2SYL. A comment about the Discone antenna. I have in front of me the antenna handbook, the ARRL antenna handbook. It's the 1982 14th edition, and there is a description in Chapter 11 here, pages 1, approximately 1120 to 1124, about the Discone that they actually have plans on how to build one. The good news is that there's a bibliography right at the end of this particular chapter of this section that has about 5 or 10 sources which you can, you know, you can refer to. And I think one of your favorite publications is your sort of here, is cited in here, the antenna handbook. Back to that.
Very fine, Bill. Good information. Yeah. One of my favorite books is the what used to be called the Jacek Antenna Engineering Handbook, and I worked with Henry Jacek. That was the first edition way back in 1980, I think it was. And there are 4 editions, and the last edition is Velasic, the publisher, editor. So Antenna Engineering Handbook, extremely good book. So the 14th edition has the disc cone antenna. The 18th edition, Mel brought to our attention, has it. And so homebrewing that antenna looks like it's going to be pretty easy. There was something else that I wanted to mention that Bill just told me. Okay, so glad that it's there. Homebrewing is good, and give it some thought. We amateurs really shine when it comes to building and testing antennas, changing the altitude, changing the feed line, using them in combination, changing the phase between them, feeding with open wire line or coax cable, making them bigger or smaller, and retuning them. It turns out any dipole-like antenna can be made at least at one frequency to give you an absolutely perfect standing wave ratio without making substantial mechanical changes to the antenna. And you can go to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You can find the article written by K2RIW telling you how to do it. It uses the so-called Brown and Woodward curve. In every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook are the Brown and Woodward curves, where what did Brown and Woodward do? Way back in 1946, approximately, they chose every possible diameter and length of monopole antenna and measured the exact impedance. And therefore, you know exactly what you're going to get when you decide what material you're going to use and how big you're going to build it. And bear in mind that they did monopole antenna testing, and every dipole is merely a pair of monopoles back to back. So whatever you read off the Brown and Woodward curve, if you're using it as a monopole, you use it directly. If you're using it as a dipole, you double whatever you read for the resistive component or the reactive component. So tuning these antennas is nowhere near as magic as you think. Let me drop. So once again, that's the main thing that I'm saying. We can really shine with building antennas. We don't build our transmitters or receivers anymore. And the exception to that is if you're building yourself a transmitter and receiver for the 10 gigahertz band or the 24 gigahertz band, where there is very little commercial equipment available, you're either going to take a piece of surplus equipment and modify it, or you're going to build from scratch. There, you're not building a zillion transistor functions with a microprocessor like all of our other rigs nowadays have. On 10 gigs, you're using, you're building a crystal-controlled converter that takes the 10 gigahertz band, converts it down to 2 meters, and then you put it into a rig like the one you're listening to, a 2-meter all-mode tunable rig with a frequency synthesizer. It becomes a tunable IF. So you're not building the whole transmitter or the whole receiver up at those higher microwave frequencies. You're taking your normal rig at the lower frequencies, 2 meters I'm calling low, because in my case, it's a second IF sometimes when I'm working on the microwave frequencies. And so you're taking your tunable IF and converting it with that extra piece of equipment to whatever frequency you want. There are lots and lots of ham bands, every single octave all the way up the band. Once you've got a ham radio license, you have a license to print money almost. By that I mean you own a hell of a lot more spectrum than any other commercial service owns. I don't know of any other service other than the Department of Defense that owns more frequencies that you get handed to you free of charge once you get that ham radio license in your hand. It's a very valuable tool if you want to do radio work, antenna work, feed line work, propagation work, and so on. You'd be amazed how many people don't know that and the fact that there are 25 or 26 kinds of ham radio. Let me drop it. I'll tell you what you're about to hear next. The next person who signed in was Wesley, N2XJN, and Wesley is on a fairly deep research project, and we can't possibly cover the whole project in any one TechNet. We're taking it in pieces. Wesley has found quite a significant number of websites which demonstrate, in theory demonstrate, machines that are greater than unity in power input versus power output, using magnetic fields and whatever. A significant number of people think that, hey, this is a kind of perpetual motion, it can't be real. Other people have said, gee, it's been going on, this kind of research in New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Hungary, Russia, United States, Canada, lots of places this kind of research is taking place. Go to the right website, you can buy plans, you can buy videos, and you can buy hardware. And you can make the measurements yourself, and in some cases, you do see what looks like greater energy out than greater energy in. Most likely, this is not quite real. Most likely, it is a kind of instrumentation error, but you can't be absolutely positive. In the process of investigating it, if you're smart enough, you'll learn something in the process. And I've come to some conclusions after looking at some of those videos as to what I think is taking place. So, Wesley's going to tell us the latest on that subject, quite possibly. And we're not going to dwell on the subject for a long time, because as I said, we're taking it in pieces. You got it, Wesley.
You're guilty, guilty, guilty.
What do you mean, oh, I'm sorry, I overtimed it, didn't I?
Guilty 100%.
Sorry about that, Eric. I guess you've got to go and reset the machine again.
Yeah, hang on a second.
You are currently connected to Reflector 9126.
Sounds like you reset it. Is that true? And we can proceed, Eric?
Yeah, go ahead, Dick.
Okay, you guys are smarter than me. Don't do what I just did. Talked for probably 2.5 solid minutes, timed out the link that goes to the Echo Link or IRLP, so therefore the people out of the area were being cut out for a period of time. So, Wesley's smarter than I am. He's not going to time out the machine. He's going to wait for the beep. He's going to look at his watch. Go right ahead, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the second minute.
B2RY, suggestion to Dick.
Joe recognized, but Wesley first. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, talking about the antennas. First, exactly know if I'm coming to right.
Beautiful. You sound beautiful. And I didn't wait for the beep, but you're going to.
Okay. I was originally trying to cover the subject of Marco Rodin. Marco Rodin, who is actually the person that I would put along the people like Nikola Tesla and Albert Einstein, for his 9-year-old child mathematics. That's how easy it is. But it's not what I'm going to be talking right now, because in the meantime, I was very much disturbed by the conversation that I did have, positively disturbed with Glenn and with Dick. And I remember when Dick was trying to challenge all known science, including antennas, in regards to the antennas and fitting lights. And I said, why should I do the same in regards to electromagnetic waves? Let me drop. Okay. Well, I have a problem with photons. Photons are carriers of electromagnetic waves. Photons are going through the straight line. That's a known knowledge. But the problem appears to be that graviton is a factor of gravity when we're talking about gravitation of the Earth. And graviton does not have a mass. Before that, I start. I have a great wording about that. Gravity is the force which should be considered in the context of whole universe. It is a broad and it's large. It forms galaxies and controls the relationship. It forms stars and planets and assembles them inside the galaxies. It is the source of all power as we know it. Sounds like a god. Let me jump for a moment. So when I just stressed the point, it is the source of all the power, as we know it, is the source of the carriers of the energy, like photons, which I had a problem with them. And if we say that the graviton is the photon that is carrying energy, carrying the charge, that's what it is, photon. in terms of gravitation, but photon is traveling through the straight line when it's carrying on the radio waves. At the same time, if you look at the sphere of the Earth, you see the curved lines. So, let me start it. Glenn and you claim, don't get offended, it's just my primitive language that is trying to express what I'm trying to say. Glenn and Dick, you both claim, based on all known science, or maybe part of the known science, that electromagnetic wave has no mass and consists from photons as carriers of energy. My claim was, and that's what I'm trying to challenge, that light does not travel through the straight lines, but the curved lines. And the example is of that. Electron has a mass and behaves like a magnet ray thanks to the existence of three quarks in it. Positron has a mass as well. But when you collide electron and positrons, what you're getting? Well, you're getting energy. You're getting energy in the form of two photons. It is well known that photons do not have a mass. But according to Glenn, he said that if you direct that photon into a nearby wall, that energy will become a mass again. Wow. You take a flashlight, start manufacturing photons, and you create a mass again.
Of that energy, and according to the Glenn statement,
And along this path, you are dealing with no mass, but pure photon, invisible. That means the energy that is in form of the photons through its path is invisible. So why then you look at the flashlight from the path of 90 degrees and you are able to see clearly the beam of light on its way? And the finish of that conversation. Albert Einstein, in his letter to astronomer Hale, October 14, 1913, expressed factors of light being bent in close proximity to the sun. That was Albert Einstein. And in May 29, 1919, for the first time, it was proven as a fact by Albert Einstein and other scientists due to the sun's position towards the moon. So it looks like you guys try to prove that magnetic field has no photons as energy. I'm talking the magnetic field has no photons as energy carriers. The magnetic field has no photons as energy carriers, but a product of it is electromagnetic wave that has photons as energy carriers. That is not true that photons are going through the straight line. Do you see the sense and the nonsense of that? And that's what I'm trying to understand. Back to you, Dick, and to HF.
Interesting. You're getting into some very basic physics here, Wesley. I believe there are a number of respected sites of information saying that a photon does have a very small amount of mass. And that would give partial explanation for the fact that you do get gravity lensing effects. Most of the good astronomy sources these days will show you very far away gravity picture, a very far away galaxy picture done with the Hubble Space Telescope, where when the light from that very distant galaxy passes near a massive galaxy that's in between us and the far one, the light does become bent. And Einstein did predict the displacement of the apparent position of Mercury as it went around the Sun because the solar mass was deflecting that light. So I think there's lots of evidence in what you're saying, that photons do have a small amount of mass, obvious by the fact that they are being bent by large masses nearby. Let me drop. And so is it the curvature of space that's doing it, or is it the real path of the photons being reflected by the local magnetic field? We could get into that kind of a discussion. So I'm with you. Photons do have a small amount of mass. We do talk about solar sail production, solar sail propulsion techniques that NASA has experimented with. A skeptic will say that, no, that was just the solar wind particles coming out from the sun being hit by that sail. Another person will say, no, the photons from the sun were hitting the sail, and that's where a substantial portion of the thrust of solar sail was coming from. So there seems to be significant evidence that photons and electromagnetic have a very small amount of mass, but it's not zero. And there's also gathering evidence that neutrinos also have a very small amount of mass. And there's multiple kinds of them. So obviously we're not going to settle this one tonight. We're going to have to move on, Wesley. But after we go through all of our questions and also the so-called Toyota thing that I want to cover a little bit, we can come back to that later on. The next person who signed in, oh, by the way, Joe had a comment he wanted to make, and then I'm going to go over to Bob. So B2RYY, go ahead with your comment, Joe. K2RYW, the second.
My comment was Dick Martin. I think was on many things. I think what Dick wanted to do is open the microphone and his computer transceiver. As that was yesterday. You know, it was a foolproof way of never climbing out the net.
Okay, I should put a timer on my microphone. And all the people who signed into the TechNet are not going to be allowed to sign in unless they can prove they got a timer on their microphone. That's a possible approach. Okay, Bob, W2ILT is next. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bob? T2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet. This is W2ILT. And I'd like to continue my discussion of automatic antenna couplers on aircraft where we left off. But I've also to talk about Wesley got involved with, so I'll let it drop. This is W2ILP again, and the dual properties of light are very confused, because we all know that light is an electromagnetic wave, just like radio is, at least in one form of understanding it, and it intrinsically travels at the speed of light, which is a constant, more or less. However, it has properties of photons, which can be exhibited in various ways. Now, Einstein was trying to unify the theory of gravity into this theory of electromagnetics, and he found it impossible. And the latest thing is string theory. And the latest thing is that gravity doesn't travel. It exists between every particle and every body in the universe. There's a force of gravity that's existing, according to an equation of physics, proportional to the mass. And what happens is that gravity can attract photons, because photons are part of the system, even though they're also a property of light. You have to go into Buddhist philosophy. I'll let it drop.
You don't have to drop it quite that long now, Bob.
There's somebody else on the frequency, and I don't know if it's because of their connection to the internet, but there's somebody else that chimes on the frequency, and I was trying to be courteous and find out who it was. But if you're copying me, okay. Are you still copying me, Dick? W2ILP, go.
We're copying you fine. Wait for the beep. Look at your watch. Please proceed.
I don't know if you gentlemen understand the fabric theory of the universe. The fabric theory of the universe chimes in with the philosophy of Buddhism. It says that everything in the universe is part of one fabric. In other words, it's big and it's wide, and everything that the universe is, it's all part of one fabric, and it's all connected together, just like the atoms in a piece of paper or in a solid object. And it exists intrinsically. It doesn't have to travel like radio waves or light. So I'll let it drop again, because I want to go back to the discussion about aircraft HF antennas.
Have a quick comment.
Go ahead.
Well, I like very much your opinion in this matter, your impact in this matter. I do. But we do not have the time right now, at least, to go deeper into the subject. But it looks like that my statement that electromagnetic waves do not go through the straight lines, although they have a tendency to go straight to straight lines, is true. That's what it looks like. I cannot simply accept the fact that photons are being utilized in the theory of the gravity of the Earth, and we are dealing with the curved line. I simply cannot understand why the 875 meters waves are the ground waves. They are bending. At least if they are not bending, I don't want to use this word, offend somebody's knowledge, but they are actually being very much absorbed by the ground. But over 30 megahertz frequencies, they are immune to the stratosphere and ionosphere, and they go through. So that means that if you have a little bit of mass, then the long wave of 75 meters has the mass that is bigger than a 10 meters wave. That's why that wave is likely to fly away. I mean, I'm talking something that might be nonsense, and I do appreciate if somebody's trying to understand that I just have a deep frustration about the fact of the sign contradicting itself. Take back 2 and 6 here.
Yeah, part of what's going on here, I've got an opinion. Inside of each true ham radio operator is a scientist trying to get out. And he's trying to understand, how does all of the stuff in the world of physics and the universe, how does it all work? Particularly, how does electromagnetic waves work? How does electrons and voltage and photons, how does it all work? We'd like to know how that radio signal propagates from point A to point B is far from easy. When it comes to the amount of bending that has been experienced and well documented by way of astrophotography, Hubble Space Telescope type pictures, and the astronomers making an interpretation of it, to get gravity lensing, to get significant bending of a wave that's made out of photons, whether it be light, radio wave, or whatever. Let me drop. To get a measurable amount of bending due to gravity effects requires an extremely large amount of gravity by your and my standards. A solar mass gave an extremely tiny amount of bending of that wave coming from Mercury to the Earth, and therefore the timing of when Mercury peaked out from behind the Sun was predictable by way of Einstein's theory, but that's an extremely small amount. The Earth, by comparison to the Sun, is an extremely small mass, even though to us it's very big. Therefore, I don't think gravity is sending any of our ham radio waves per se. I think every bit of it is ionospheric effect and atmospheric refraction effect, particularly when it comes to microwaves. A person who is doing 10 gigahertz work experiences, let me drop, he experiences a band opening essentially every 24-hour day, particularly if he lives within 200 miles of a body of water. Beyond roughly midnight, I have on many occasions on the 10 gigahertz band talked to somebody way beyond my line of sight. My line of sight from the top of my tower is less than 40 miles. But on multiple occasions, I've talked to people as much as 380 miles away using, in my case, 200 milliwatts, real QRP-type stuff. And I'm talking about single sideband, not just weak Morse code. And what's going on is that at nighttime, beyond midnight, you tend to get dew forming in the atmosphere as cooling takes place. You get a higher moisture content in the air down low, a lower moisture content up high, drier air up high. The higher moisture content air has a higher dielectric constant, so that dielectric refraction effect creates a bending of the wave. And when the wave bends at the rate of the Earth's curvature, we call it super refraction. That guy 390 miles away, even though he's almost 10 times beyond your radio horizon, he sounds like he's in your backyard. If you're on the 10 gig ham band, you can experience that probably 4 nights at least out of every single week, summer, winter, spring, and fall. So an awful lot of the bending of our radio waves is refractive effect, and is the ionosphere giving us a bounce, a refraction, or a diffraction? I think it's refraction of that particular plasma. What's really going on in the ionosphere? You can get some pretty deep discussions on that. But let's go back to what Bob wants to cover, and that is the way we do our antenna tuning. That antenna tuner, that matchbox, is a very controversial tool in the ham radio world today. The number of misinformation opinions on that one is pretty darn large, and Bob's going to bring our feet back down to the ground. 52ILP, go ahead, Bob. Wait for the beep, and watch you watch. K2RIW.
This is WILP again. And last week, we were talking about an all-band HF transceiver. On this particular case, we were talking about the leading edge of the tail fin and trying to load it up everywhere from 2 to 30 megahertz from the transceiver using an automatic antenna coupler. And the automatic antenna coupler is the power amplifier. It is 4S38S3. Another version is the S5, which is sealed in nitrogen, pressurized. problem that I was trying to bring up when I started talking about the ham antenna on a mobile setup, where you have a put the antenna that's perhaps 8 feet long, works as a quarter wave on 10 meters, and then you decide you want to use it on 20 meters. So you get a loading coil, and you install that at the bottom of the whip, you're back in business. You can load on 20 meters. Better still would be to get a hill whip, which is only about 8 feet long, and wraps the wire around progressively, wraps it around helically on the fiberglass rod that makes it much better, more efficient setup than having the base load. I'll let it drop. Anyway, what happens when you have this situation of the antenna setup, and let's say we put the coil, instead of being at the bottom of the antenna or a stick set anywhere along the antenna, we put it inside the trunk of the car. And that's what's really happening when you tune up that short length of vertical fin and try to get it to work at the lower frequencies. You have to add inductance, and you can't hear it outside the airplane. You're adding it inside the antenna tuner. So effectively, part of your load is a dummy load with that coil, and the rest of it is whatever protrudes on each thing. You're not getting the full efficiency. Let it drop.
Yeah, I've got a question on that one, Bob. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead with your question.
Okay, if I am smart enough to build my antenna tuner out of high-quality, low-loss components, I'm using capacitors that have very little equivalent series resistance, I'm using inductors that have very little equivalent series resistance, and I'm putting that antenna tuner in a well-shielded box. So of all the energy I put into that antenna tuner box, there's only three things that can happen. Because of fanning away ratio, some of it reflects back to the transmitter, I can control that. I can make the Biswell one-to-one when I properly tune it. Number two, it can turn some of that power I put into it into heat, only if there's loss in the components. Or three, it can radiate the power into space. Well, if the box is shielded, it can't radiate. If I've adjusted the fanning wave ratio low enough on the transmitter side, it's not reflecting. And if the components are high enough in quality, it's not absorbing power and turning it into heat. If I can put my hands on the box, and the box is ice cold, when I run the transmitter 100 watts key down for 5 minutes, I say that that antenna tuner is running at near 100% efficiency. I'll admit that what I just said is controversial. I've done the experiment. I think I see those results.